If you read our book, and I wouldn't accuse anyone of doing that, but if you read our book, it does talk about the disease of alcoholism being a family disease. And the gentleman who's here tonight, I got a chance to meet because he was here visiting his daughter, who is also here. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say. So please welcome all the way from Sacramento area, Pat.
My name is Pat Patterson, and I am an alcoholic. First thing I like to say is I'm scared, because it kind of takes some of the power out of it. It's kind of hard to stand up here in front of my peers and tell the truth, but I will do my best. I was born in Fresno. I was raised in Sacramento. My daughter was born in Tulare, and my other two daughters were born in Washington, so I kind of like got around a little bit. I started drinking when I was 15. I classify it as drinking successfully, because if you only black out a few times and you're experimenting is what I was doing, so I was pretty okay with my drinking habits. And when I turned 18, I joined the Navy. Actually, I joined at 17. I was an incorrigible, so to get off that list, I joined the Navy, and then they dropped the incorrigible part. Actually, I was just a thief. Anyway, so I went in the Navy, and in the Navy you get to drink. I was 18 years old and traveling all over the world, and they didn't, most of the time they didn't care how old I was. I was in Milwaukee, and I had a phony ID, and I just walked in, and I had an ID that says I was 36, and I was 18, and I looked 15. The guy looked at it, and he just laughed, and said, "What do you want?" And so I ordered whatever it was I ordered. I don't even remember, but anyway, I had a couple of drinks, and I was so tickled, I went back to the base, and I bragged about it for the next couple of years. But I went to the Eagles Club in Milwaukee, and we drank before we got there because you couldn't drink there. It didn't matter how old you were. All the girls were there, and so we get to dance, and so we drink, and then we go to the dance, and we dance, and. I thought I was a better dancer whenever I was drunk. I'm not too sure the girls like being stepped on, but that's what I did. And the only reason I didn't drink more is I couldn't get it. I would have drank more, but you just couldn't get it. I had school to do and all kinds of stuff. And then once you got aboard ship, is they kind of control your drinking, because we go out to sea for 44 days, and if I didn't stash a little rum in the villages of the ship, I didn't get the drink. And I didn't always have money left over after going ashore, so I didn't always have booze whenever I got back, because I drank it while I was on shore. And I did what they call a westback. That's where you go overseas for 6 months, and we stayed 8, and we go into port, and we drink from the time we were in port till we went out of port, and that's what everybody did, so I still consider that pretty normal. And then this one time, we went on this little island. We were sailing up and down the Saigon River because we were a tin can and we could shoot 8 miles away with our 5-inch guns. And so we couldn't get back to the Philippines, so we went to an island to have a little R&R. So we went to this little island and had a ship tender who fixes ships, but we didn't need anything repaired. We just went there to party, and so they had nice white sandy beaches, and so they borrowed a couple of these little speedboats and took everybody to shore along with several cases of San Miguel beer. San Miguel beer is really kind of cool stuff because it's either 1% or 20%, but you don't know which one it is until you start drinking it. So like one night I could drink a case, and the next night I couldn't even drink a six-pack because you didn't know which part of it you were getting. And so I always thought I was a good drinker because I drank a lot, that, you know, it was probably the 1% stuff. But the night I drank the 20% stuff, I didn't last very long. But we went on shore, and I didn't drink, so I couldn't be a drunk, right? And so I just kept doing that sort of stuff all the time I was in the Navy. And then I got out of the Navy, and I was stationed in San Diego, and I met a gal who came down with a friend of mine, and she was about 5 foot tall and nicely built, and he didn't seem to want her, so I took her, and whenever I got out of the Navy, she lived in Pixley, and so I moved to Pixley and married her, and was going to live happily ever after right down the road. And my oldest daughter was born in Tulare Hospital, and I didn't drink much in those days. I was too busy having babies and trying to find work and all that stuff. It's not that I didn't want to drink, I just didn't drink much. But I told my daughter this last month that I knew when she took her first drink. I was some of my Navy buddies come over, and she's like 10, 11 months old and barely walking, and we drink these bloody beers, and all it is tomato juice and beer, and throw a little salt on it if you want or not. But we drink these things, and all of a sudden my daughter starts like staggering, and took us a little while to figure that out, but she'd been now I never left anything in the bottom of a cup ever, but my buddies would, and she'd go around drinking it all, and she would just start staggering all over the place, and went to bed early that night and slept all night, and we thought we might make that a habit, but we didn't, luckily. But anyway, so that's when she had her first drink. But I joined the bowling league in Porterville and started drinking again. And I loved to bowl and drink. I thought the two went together. I thought I was a better bowler whenever I drank. And sometimes I was and sometimes I wasn't. But I never knew which day it would be. Some days I would bowl really good and some days I wouldn't. I drank the same amount or I drank more or less. But I spent a lot of years bowling and a lot of years drinking. I still considered that normal drinking. I didn't black out too many times and all that. And then we moved to Washington. My dad offered, I was working at Rockwell in Porterville, and my dad offered me a job laying floors in Washington. He was going to make a floor cover out of me. And my pay at Rockwell was like $2.50, and If I went up there and laid floors for him, I'd get half of the journeyman, which was $235, and that I would go to $5 in 3 years, because that's what journeyman got paid. Now, I did that 40 years, and whenever I quit, I was making about $40 an hour, so it wasn't too bad of a living. But we went up to Washington, I didn't drink the first year I was up there, but as soon as I joined the bowling league, I started drinking. And so now, this is how, if you want to increase your drinking, this is how, now I bowl one night a week, and whenever I was done bowling, I bowled up to 23 years ago, is whenever I was done bowling, I was bowling every night of the week. So I went from one night of the week drinking to every night of the week drinking. And that was just in my normal drinking days. And I'll explain all this in a little bit. But when I was 27 years old, I went to work one morning, and I got a phone call. And the phone call said that my daughter was hurt, and I needed to make it to a hospital. And the hospital was in Vancouver, Washington, and I was in Portland, Oregon. And so I had to drive across the river and go to this hospital. And whenever I got to the hospital, my doctor came out and told me my three-year-old daughter was killed. And she was run over by my mailman in my front yard while my other daughter was getting the mail from him. He didn't pay attention, and he drove over my three-year-old daughter and killed her. And from that moment on, I drank different. I drank every chance I got. And my entire life changed, and so did everybody around me, because I now was the selfishest man on earth. And I would remain that way till the day I sobered up. Is I didn't care about another human being other than myself. And the reason why I know that is because of my behavior. Is I went to the bar, and whenever I came out of it, my wife and my kids were gone. My wife was pregnant with my third daughter, and they were both gone, after all three of them. So being and who I am, as I found another woman and moved in with her, and she had a son, and so I started raising him, and I raised him very selfishly. I didn't give him much, he would have lots of problems, and I have to talk to my portion of that. I moved to back to California because my ex-wife kept putting me in jail for non-support and all the other things that I wasn't doing that I was supposed to be doing, and I got tired of getting arrested. And so I came to California, and not too long after I got here, she came down and moved back to Central California, and then I started getting rested again. And so, being I'm who I am, is I started what we call scabbing, and that means I was working under the table most of the time so that she couldn't track my money. And I'd work for cash or whatever, and I spent the next umpteen years not paying for child support, and they were living on welfare, and I was wheeling and dealing with my two daughters, which I actually separated them for 3 years because I thought I was going to be the better parent, and that didn't work out so well, and caused both my girls a lot of trouble. and I hate talking about this. Usually I can, on a short chair, I can leave out all this part, but this is why I drink, is to not feel this type of behavior, not feel what I was doing to my daughters, not feel what I was doing to my stepson, not feel what I was doing to the women that were in my life, and I don't, anyway, when I was, right after my daughter died, I got a DUI in Washington, and so I decided that, I read something somewhere, heard something that you couldn't become an alcoholic if you just drank beer. And so from the time I was 28 till I was 41, I drank beer. I drank lots of beer. And, because I didn't want to become an alcoholic. And, anyway, through all this behavior, I was married. I was on my third wife, and it's now 1987, and it is the first part of June, and my wife needs to go to Southern California to see her dad alive for the last time, and she did that, and she came home, and then he died right after she got home, and so she turned around and went back to Southern California and buried her dad. And while she was gone, those 2 weeks, is I drank like you cannot believe. And when she was going to come home, I knew she was going to kick me out of the house, and our relationship was going to end, because she was pretty well done with me. We'd been married 3.5 years, and I lied my ass off to get her because she's a really cool lady, and if I told her the truth, if I would have shown her who I really was, is she wouldn't have married me. So I had my daughter ask her to marry me. And so my daughter did. Actually, what my daughter said, so you and Dad are getting married. Because what I told my daughter was, I asked her if she could marry somebody like me, and she said yes. So my daughter thought she said yes, but she said that she could marry somebody like me is all she said. But my daughter said, Chuck, I'm not, of course, ad-lib or dressed up the story for telling it, but anyway, so she thought about it anyway, and she decided that she just turned 40. And if you're single and you've been single for several years and you just turned 40, I'm sure she was in some sort of crisis of her own, but I was 38 and younger than her, and so I thought I was a good catch, and I had a job. I wasn't working in floor covering, but I had a job. I was a termite guy. I crawled underneath houses and removed termites because there was no money to be made in floor covering at this time, and so that's what I did. But So she's going to come home and kick me out of the house. And so I called one of my bowling buddies, and it was probably my last friend on earth that I didn't work and drink with. And anyway, I was at the Ruby's Hideaway, and you know, it's almost in Folsom, but it's kind of like between two towns. And anyway, I was sitting there drinking beer after working at Eurojet, and I called this gal, and she says, well, why don't you meet me at such and such Four Seasons restaurant, and we'll talk. And so I drank a six-pack, and I met her at Four Seasons, and she kept asking me these two questions. She says, do you have a problem with alcohol, and do you want help? And, of course, James, I'm who I am. I told her, well, I didn't tell her anything. I just ignored that and went on with another story. And I was trying to impress her because I was going to need a new woman pretty soon. And I thought she might be it. And anyway, she kept asking these two questions. And finally, I said, yeah, I have a problem drinking, and I would like help. And she says to me, if you'll stay sober for 24 hours, I will take you to an AA meeting. Now, I didn't know what an AA meeting was, but I said yes. And then I went home, and I knew it had something to do with my drinking, and I knew it had something to do with health, but she didn't go into it because she didn't want to scare me away. And so anyway, I got home and sober, and I woke up the next day sober, and my wife comes home, and the first thing she asked me is, what have you been up to? And I says, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight. Now, I don't know if she knew what it was or not, but it seemed to cheer her up, and she didn't tell me to get out of the house. So I was like okay with this AA stuff. So I went to my first AA meeting on June 28, 1987. And it was at Gibbons Alano Club. And if any of you have been to Sacramento, it's a little house. It's had a bunch of add-ons, and the meeting room is in an add-on on the side of the house. And it's a long, skinny room, and the door was right in one corner of it. And I had one of these type chairs, one leg out that door. And I knew I was okay, because my back was to a door, and I knew I was okay. And for those of you who drank at some of the bars I drank, is you know to get your back to a wall and have everything in front of you, and you also know where the door is. So being I'm the alcoholic that I am, as I sat there, and they asked for newcomers, and I told them I had 24 hours. And I don't know if they cheered or not, but at all of our other meetings, they cheer whenever you first come in, or like the first year is like really a big deal, but I don't remember any of that. What I do remember is there were some young people there, and they were talking about drinking cough syrup and Listerine and wine and whatever else they could get their hands on to get a high, and I didn't relate, because after all, I was just a beer drinker. And anyway, they drank a lot of stuff, anyway, so the gal asked me what I thought about the meeting, and I says, well, it was all right, but and she asked me if I'd come back, and I told her yes, because I knew that was the right answer, not because I was coming back, but because I knew that was the right answer. And so the next night, I went home and I told my wife that I'm not like those people. I'm different. And she says to me, why don't you go to another one? That really pissed me off, because I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I wasn't liking it. And so they gave me a schedule, and the next night I went to go to another meeting right down the street from my house. And I drove to this church, and I sat in the parking lot, and at about 5 minutes to eight, nobody showed up. And I go, I got it made. There's no meeting tonight. And so I had to make a choice. And I think this is one of those spiritual experiences they talk about in the book, the turning point, is I could choose a meeting, or I could choose to go home, or I could choose to go to the bar. And I really wanted to go to the bar. And I knew I couldn't go home. And so I did what I didn't expect me to do. I went to a meeting. And I went to a place called Sharing and Caring. It's in Sacramento. And if you're angry, lonely, tired, and just kind of hateful, it is the best place on earth for you. Because at this place is where all the cowboys, Indians, bikers, construction workers show up. And we're all angry. It's nothing at all in this meeting to have a chair fly across the room or a table get tipped over accidentally. And it's not for everybody. If you're a little normal, is you go in there and the hair on the back of your neck will stand right up because you'll know everybody in the room's like a little pissed. But I fit right in. And the only that is in this room is you couldn't see across the room because of the smoke. And I knew I was home. It looked just like the bars I was in. And so from that moment on, I fell in love with sharing and caring. And I chaired meetings and secretaried and did everything that they asked me. I made coffee. Whatever they wanted me to do, that's what I did. I sobered up just before the 4th of July. And so what I did on 4th of July was I made banana bread and slept in the at sharing and caring on the couches that they had. And because I was afraid that if I didn't do that, I'd get drunk. And I would have. And so I don't know whether it was my 30-day, 60-day, 90-day chip, but anyway, I was standing up on a thing like this here, and they were giving out these little key rings with a chip on it, and this biker by the name of Filthy Phil was up giving up chips, and he had like 3 years of sobriety, anyway, so I step up on the thing there, and he gives me my chip, and I turn around to walk away, and he says, "Oh, no, we hug here." And I go, "Oh, no, we don't." And he says, "Oh, yes, we do." And so my first hug in Alcoholics Anonymous was from Filthy Phil. And he was still packing, by the way, because you could feel he's 38 underneath his leather jacket. So... yeah, he was not the healthiest alcoholic I ever met, but he was trying just like me. And anyway, so I spent the first 6 months there running from everything, running from the steps, running from everybody, just making coffee and smoking cigarettes and doing my thing. And I was going to probably 3 meetings a day. Because they had 4 meetings a day, and I couldn't make it to the noon one every day, but I tried. And at about 6 months sober, my stepson's mom calls me up, and she says, "We're having trouble with Doug, and that we need to do something about this." So I sent 2 young people over with a big book to 12-stepping, and he calls me up the next day and says, "Dad, I do not have a problem with drinking or drugs. I'm just fine." And 3 months later, he put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. And he was not quite 21 years old. And so I know not everybody makes it here. He never made it to his first AA meeting, so not everybody makes it here. I knew that. And I was right on my 4th step, and he was on my list. And so I didn't get to make my amends to him except to his cremation. I made my amends to that because that was the best I could do. And I did that whenever I was working the 9th step. I have done a lot of things in AA, and they say that some of us need outside help, and so I've had 12 years of counseling. I have both an AA and an Al-Anon sponsor. I was 12-step by Al-Anon. The little gal that took me to my first AA meeting had been going to Al-Anon and AA to sober up her dad, and she sobered up me instead, and her dad died. He never made it to his first AA meeting. I've stood up on stage, and it was an ACA play, and I don't know why they cast me as a drunk, but that's what they cast me as. And it was a big room like this here, and a stage just like this here, and we had a table there, and we were all sitting around it. And my job was to get really, really angry and stomp off stage and leave my coat behind. And they had an empty bottle of beer sitting in front of me, which just really messed with me. I want you to know that. Even though it was empty, I was supposed to tip that some bitch to my mouth. And I can't tell you how hard that is to do whenever you know it's empty and you haven't had one in like 3 or 4 years. It was the hardest thing I ever did, was to tip that thing to my mouth and act like I was drinking. And because of that, it set off all kinds of old behavior. And so whenever it was my time to exit, is I was already like really angry because there wasn't any booze in it. So whenever I stood up really fast, is the chair I was in tips over and slams on the floor, and that room went silent. And this wasn't supposed to happen, so my co-actors kind of panicked a little bit, and my coat was going to fall, and so I grabbed my coat as the chair slammed to the floor, and I turned around and went off stage. Well, part of the acting thing was the son in the play was supposed to give me my coat and went running after me with my coat. Well, my coat wasn't there, so what he had to do was he grabbed my beer and said, "Dad, you forgot your beer." And said, "Dad, you forgot your coat." And anyway, it was awesome, and I had like 300 people hissing at me and booing me, and I went to a meeting a couple nights later, and I shared, and this kid in the room walked up to me after the meeting. He said, "You were the drunk. I recognized you at that play the other night." And I said, "Yes, I was." He said, "You were awesome. You were just like my dad." So, anyway, I've done speaker meetings where me and my wife, my sponsor and her sponsor, were the speakers. I've done Al-Anon meetings. That's where we all get together, and it doesn't make any difference what your addiction is, whether it's drugs, overeating, alcohol, and people. I'm addicted to work or anything else that I do well. My sponsor, they have a similar meeting. They meet once a month, and everybody brings something, and they have a little potluck, and then they have a meeting afterwards. And the things you can get here are unbelievable. In 2000, I lost my best friend. And he sobered up 11 months after I did. He asked me to be his sponsor. And he was running a 26-mile marathon, and he was training for it, and he was out on the bike trail, and his heart gave out on him. And it was in 1999, and he died. And I got to stand up in front of a whole bunch of people, but I was sitting in the front row with the family, and so I didn't know that there was like twice as many people here, maybe three times. And so as I'm walking up, is I don't know how many people behind me, and I turned around and I saw how many people were in the room, and not one of them were you guys who knew me. These were all just people that knew him, and I didn't know how many of them were in the program or not in the program, but there wasn't very many. And they were all co-workers and whatnot. He was a lineman for Ma Bell. But anyway, so I stood up here, and I knew I couldn't talk about him without crying. So I told him that I'm scared to death, and I can't talk without crying. And so I talked about him and me and AA and drugs and 12-stepping him and taking him through the steps and how much more I learned from him than he did from me and how he was my best friend and I didn't talk to him for the last 3 years of his life because I was too busy and I was always going to call him and I didn't. And so nowadays is if I think I need to talk to somebody, I just call them. I don't wait because I don't want them to die and it'd be 3 years and I haven't talked to my best friend. But I make those phone calls today. And in 2000, both the saddest and one of the greatest days of my life would happen in 2000. My oldest grandson was 11 years old, and that was as long as his heart was going to last. And I got a phone call from my daughter telling me that if I wanted to see him alive, I needed to drive to L.A., and that I needed to hurry. And so I don't know why there weren't any cops on the freeway that day, but I had a little Pathfinder, and it was nicknamed the Pathfinder, and I put it at 110 miles an hour, and I drove from Sacramento to L.A. and broke into the hospital because my grandson was not doing well. And the security there was come after me because I'm entering a part of the hospital I'm not supposed to be in, but I'm a construction worker, and I know I work on hospitals, and so I know how to get around. And so I'm headed to lights, and this security officer, he's a little bitty guy, he comes up alongside of me, and I don't know what I look like, but he wouldn't get close to me. And so I was probably pretty fierce, and he says, "You need to talk to my boss." And I says, "Okay." And so he took me to his boss, and this black kid's like joining me up one side and down the other. And I told him, I said, "Look, whenever you're done, I need you to tell me where Devin is." And so he looked up Devin's room, and I went up there, and I spent the rest of the night with him. It was probably 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I finally ran out of gas. I went and slept an hour, and I came back out, and they wouldn't let me back in his room, and I knew something bad was wrong. And so we all got together in a separate room, and my daughter made the decision to unplug him from the machine. And so we all went out, and her mother couldn't bear this, and so her mother needed to leave the room. So while my grandson was dying, I got to hold my daughter and her husband while he passed. And it was the saddest and the most powerful moment in my life because it changed me. I can't tell you, I've not been the same since 2000. I've not been angry. I've not been any of the things I was the day before that. I've been more spiritual. I've been easier to get along. And my daughter needed to do what we call a geographic, and so she needed to go back east. And she asked me if I would help, and I told her no. That I'm not helping you take my... She's pregnant with my other grandson, and I'm not... And she had him a couple weeks later, and I'm not going to help you go to the East Coast, but I'll help you get back. And she went to the East Coast, and a few months later, she calls me up, and she says, "I need help getting back, Dad." And I said, "Absolutely, how much you need?" And she gave me a figure, and I sent it to her that same day. And she came back to California, from 2000 till just this year, I've been on cloud nine. I've had 10 years of grace, the last few months have been our last few weeks have been a little rough. My wife's oldest daughter has cancer, and it's in her leg, and I go to radiation every day with her, and the only reason I'm not going there tomorrow is because I'm here. And I want to... part of my story I don't like talking about, but I have to, is I spent a lot of years away from AA. I still work the program. I just didn't go to meetings. But I know the big book in and out. I know the steps and the traditions in and out. I practice them every day of my life, every minute of my life. And I just got busy, and God has seemed to make me a kayaker and an artist. These paintings on the wall, I can do most of them. I do oils and pastels, and I'm a class 5 kayaker. Before I turn 60, I'm a few years older than that now, so I try not to go kill myself. I'm not on a suicide mission. I'm just on a adrenaline mission. I love it. But anyway, I spent a lot of years away, and a year ago tomorrow, my oldest daughter called me up and said, "Dad, I have a problem with alcohol. What can I do about it?" So I told her that she could go to the hospitals and they would help her. She could go to churches and they would help her. Or she can go to Alcoholics Anonymous and they would help her. And she says, I did the AA way. And so she says, "I think I'll do it your way." And she went to her first AA meeting 1 year ago tomorrow. She will be sober 1 year tomorrow. And I was looking at my program and I go, "My program sucks." And so I started going back to meetings. And I'm secretary of a meeting, and I've had the literature and all kinds of stuff. And they haven't had me, in the old days I'd empty ashtrays and all that, but they don't even smoke in meetings anymore, so I can't empty ashtrays but I couldn't make coffee, but they haven't asked me to do that. And the reason why I'm here is my daughter was getting her 30-day chip, and I needed to come down here and check out AA and Visea because I didn't know what kind of AA you had here, and I needed to know what kind of AA was in Visea. So I come running down here. I told her I was coming down for a 30-day chip, but that's not why I was here. As I came down here to check out the AA, and she took me to a meeting down here, and it was a little odd. Is everybody in the room had almost zero time, and they all had cards, and this one guy talked 5 times. I know, I counted them. And in Sacramento, if he was in Sacramento, after he talked the second time, the third time, I would have stopped him. Told him to shut up and listen. But I didn't know that you guys didn't do that down here, so I didn't want to step on anybody's toes. But anyway, I was not happy. And so my daughter says, "Don't worry about that. I'll take you to another meeting." So we went to another meeting, and they did it just exactly the way we do it in Sacramento. And so I was happy, and I left Visea thanking my daughter. And I also met her sponsor, and it was really cool. So there's good AA and Visea. I know that because my daughter is coming up on 1 year, and the way it works is one-on-one. It's one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And if you didn't hear anything that you related to from me, there's lots of meetings all over this state. I've been to a lot of them. And somebody will tell your story. My story has been told many times. Not everybody has suffered the tragedies I've suffered, Those of us who walk through this pain can share that with you if you ever walk through the pain. Because that's what we do here, is it's one alcoholic helping another. And I think I've talked long enough. We're out of time, but if when I was here last, we don't do this in Sacramento, but they asked if anybody would like to ask me a question. And I would love to answer questions if you have any. Bill says that you don't always participate in that, but a few people did the last time I was here, and I thought that was the greatest thing. Because if you have any questions that you would like to ask me, I would love to answer them. Yes? I didn't hear that. My name is Pat Patterson, and I am an alcoholic. I didn't think so for a long time, but I thought I just drank normal. After all, yes. When I lost my grandson. Well, two things is my daughter was pregnant with my supposedly a granddaughter, and the story is that my grandson I lost changed my granddaughter into a grandson because that's what he wanted. That's what the family says. I'm not too sure about that. But what was my motivation in all that was that for the first time in 20 years, I got outside of myself and was there for somebody else. Because I was there for my daughter and my son-in-law. And for the first time in a lot of years, I was no longer selfish. That I did all my AA, all that stuff for me, is I was an I person. But I've been that for a long time. It's real easy for me to talk about me. Does that help? Anybody else? Thank you.